Game on, weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies for driving it through the afternoon. It's Wednesday, 13th of July. I'm Dave Kelly, and this is Game On. Coming up today, we're live to Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson at St Andrews on the eve of the 150th Open. Paul Corrie has the latest on more Irish players on the move, including Shane Long's return to Reading. In ladies football, Nadine Doherty reflects on Donegal's shock win over Dublin. In Camogie, Aoife Murphy previews the weekend's All-Ireland quarterfinals, and we bring you the latest as the GAA break their silence on Hawkeye. If you want to get in touch, you can text on 51552 or tweet at GameOn 2FM.
GameOn on 2FM.
And a very good evening. As we said, we're joined in studio by Paul and Nadine for tonight's programme. And Nadine, just a quick word. We'll obviously be going back to it in more detail later, but still in shock at that Donegal win?
In shock, but absolutely delighted, Dave. I'm smiling all week. They're incredible. You know, I get a bit of a slagging in here because I just pump them up so high every year. And last week, I just did not see it coming. But credit to the girls. They put that performance together that we knew they could, but didn't see coming. And they were fully deserving of their win. So they're knuckling down, I'd imagine, with the semi-final now on Saturday. So no time to think about it. But yeah, delighted for them.
Yeah, very much so. And as I said, we'll be looking ahead to those semi-finals and back on the other games at the weekend. Later in the programme. And Paul, Shamrock Rovers last night, I suppose, taking a 3-0 advantage into the second leg and never really in too much danger.
No, Dave, I think you're bang on with that. I mean, the heavy lifting was done last week with that 3-0 win at home in Tala, and it was very professional performance last night. I thought they managed the game well. Not always easy when you have that lead, you can sometimes get complacent, but they sat in, and I expect them to sit in and just maybe frustrate Hibernians, and they did that quite well. Kept possession of the ball at times when they needed to, and it's a huge win for them. I mean, just looking there in advance of the show, the guaranteed pot they were before last night was 800k. That has now gone to 1.4 million, which is huge for Irish football, particularly when you think of the sums that are at reach for Irish teams when they win the league here domestically. It's not substantial. European ventures are where the money is to be made, and Shamrock Rovers have given them a really good chance now of going further, hopefully to a group stage, whether that be in the Europa League or the Conference League, if they were to get knocked out of the Champions League. But everything pointing in the right direction. Graham Burke and Jack Byrne back on the bench last night. You would imagine in this Ludogorets fixture next week, they're going to be, you know, pivotal to Shamrock Rovers and how far they go in that two-legged tie.
Yeah, and as we said, we'll be discussing that and the other football stories later in the programme. But if you're a golf fan like myself, there's a feeling of Christmas Eve, I suppose, about today. The eve of the Open Championship, really looking forward to it. So many good Irish stories involved as well, and hopefully the Irish challenge will be strong heading into the weekend. Let's take a detailed look ahead now, and there at St Andrews for us is Greg Allen. Greg.
Yeah, hi Dave, great to hear you in the chair and Game On. I'm in the chair here in St Andrews in the RT position with someone who's very familiar to us, Doug Ferguson from Associated Press, and we've been listening to a great deal of press conference material over the past couple of days, which has not really dominated the landscape of preview here, because clearly this is a massive occasion in the major championship historic rota, because this is the 150th edition of the Open Championship, dating all the way back to 1860. The original major golf championship reaches its 150th anniversary, and yet as much as everybody wants to talk about that, there's just no escaping the very sizable large animal in the room that is LIV Golf. Yesterday we heard Tiger Woods coming out opposing the notion and the concept of LIV Golf and what it is doing to the world of professional golf, but you know, really giving it a fairly stern rebuke, almost a dismissive rebuke, saying that the guaranteed prize money, which is, you know, just extraordinarily high, they're allegedly, not allegedly, but they're competing for, you know, that $4 million first prize in the two LIV Golf events that have been staged so far at Centurion near London and in Portland, Oregon. Just massive amounts of money. And Tiger said, where's the incentive, you know, to dig it out of the dirt? In the old Hogan-esque way of expressing the level of competition that's required in golf. And he didn't like the idea of, I suppose, the LIV concept having that lack of competitive element. Everybody's guaranteed a great big paycheck at the end of the day. So there was more today. We had the RNA, which has basically not so much sat on the fence for the past few months regarding the LIV Golf Series. They just haven't come out and taken the opportunity to say what clearly has been going through the minds of many of the members of the Royal and Ancient, which is incidentally the governing body of the game, the amateur game for sure, but also it's the rulemaking body along with the United States Golf Association for the globe other than the United States and Mexico, and they also run, of course, the Open Championship. This was what their CEO Martin Slumbers had to say today about LIV Golf and the two events that he's seen so far.
I believe the model we've seen at Centurion and Pumpkin Ridge is not in the best long-term interests of the sport as a whole and is entirely driven by money. We believe it undermines the merit-based culture and the spirit of open competition that makes golf so special. I would also like to say that, in my opinion, the continued commentary that this is about growing the game is just not credible.
And I think part of the words that were carefully prepared there, the tone of the rhetoric was fairly stiff rebuke stuff. I'm sitting here with Doug Ferguson, who's covered this story from much closer quarters than I have. You know, I'm not sure, were you in Portland, Oregon for the LIV Golf? You weren't, but you. You have covered this all quite closely. What did you make of this today?
It was strong, and it was stern, and he cut right through the heart of it. A, it's money-driven. B, you've eliminated. I thought it was clever, actually, the way he talked about the history of the game, which whether you're playing as a professional or playing as an amateur, and Tiger spoke to it as well, you're working at it. You're digging it out of the dirt. Kind of a popular phrase, I guess, in golf. It's all merit-based, and there are no free lunches. There's appearance money. Let's not turn around. That's part of the modern game, is appearance money here and there. But that appearance money is also earned. In other words, Rory doesn't get appearance money unless Rory's put together the record he has. Everything is earned in golf. And they are throwing away money at people that don't sell a ticket even to their family. That's the part that's always been so kind of obnoxious about the whole thing. And now, you know, you've got Greg Norman and other players kind of repeating, you know, almost like puppets, the theme of a force for good, and this is growing the game. And I thought that's kind of what's interesting, that Martin brought that out on his own, is enough of this stuff. Enough of this growing the game business, because it's only growing the wallets of a select few. So, you know, for him to speak strongly about that was good. And frankly, I think he was the first one who really had that opportunity. I suppose Mike Wann of the USGA could have gone stronger, and he also, I think, made his points fairly clear. But this thing only started after the PGA, the first LIV event in London, and then more names started trickling in even after the U.S. Open before we got off to Portland. So it's still kind of early stages in what this is going to be. Now we kind of see where it's going. Martin sees where it's going, and he made his point very clearly, especially the part about there's no guarantee for these boys going forward of getting into the Open based on merit, actually. I mean, based on a qualification system.
So just before we get into what is the most important thing to be discussing this week, which is the 150th Open, between Tiger Woods saying what he said, the way he said it, not sitting on the fence, taking the opportunity to severely rebuke the LIV model, and the RNA with Martin Slumbers today doing similar, are these two torpedoes which will, to some degree, turn LIV into what the main established powers bases in golf want to be, a sideshow in golf? They know that LIV is going to be there, but might this relegate it or help to relegate it into the sideshow that the main tours, the PGA Tour, the TP World Tour, the USGA, and now the RNA want it to be?
Is this where I'm supposed to disagree with you if I can? Okay.
Absolutely.
it's a big moment, and it's an important moment. Tiger, you know, Tiger first had a chance to address this, and again, early stages, because we didn't know what LIV Golf was going to be when Tiger first spoke about this in the Bahamas last December, clearly out against it. But that was some of his most eloquent speaking for someone for whom eloquent speaking doesn't come naturally. And the RNA, and we know exactly where the body of golf stands. But I think it's easy for us to say, well, this is a big moment for traditional golf, conventional golf, to take its stand. We're also at the 150th Open. Tomorrow morning we're going to be talking about whether Paul Laurie can put it in the fairway. That's kind of a joke. Of course he can. You know, we're going to see Rory go off and Rahm and Scheffler and how Tiger fares, and we're going to be talking about the Open Championship for the next 4 days. When we get home, some of us lucky enough to go to Ireland, the rest of us stuck in the United States, it's going to pop up again. And when you've got that void, that's when LIV gets some traction. That's what we've seen in the U.S. You've noticed, I mean, the last tournament for sure in Portland was played against the John Deere Classic, which was never going to get anybody of note in that field just because of where it is, and the week before St. Andrews and a Scottish Open that was available to them, et cetera, et cetera. And so they kind of dominated the headlines for the week. Now, when you get back to the U.S. At the tournament in Minnesota, and I believe they're in around here for the Kazoo, if I said that correctly, Open. There's a fairly smallish European Tour event. Then the eyes of golf shift back to LIV. And I think the tough part is no majors again until Augusta. So the next word comes from Augusta. This was an important day. There's still one really, really big shoe, bigger than Tony Finau's shoes, to drop, and that's Augusta.
Okay, well, we're going to talk about golf because clearly I think all of us are not tired of talking about this because it is, well, maybe we are tired about talking about it, but it has to be spoken about because it is just such a big element in golf right now. It's driving up prize funds on the PGA Tour. It's driving up prize funds on the DP World Tour. The response of the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour to have a stronger strategic alliance could actually end up being good for golf. And who knows, we may look back in a couple of years' time at a sideshow type of golf tour called the LIV Golf League or whatever it's going to be next year, but that actually has had an effect to improve prize funds in golf to the point where, you know, you're talking about stratospheric amounts of money, 20 million for 11 events on the PGA Tour, which is modelled for 2024 and beyond. But let's talk about Tiger, because he's been so front and centre of the conversation this week with regard to this 150th Open, with good reason, because he's an Open champion here from his victories in 2000 and 2005. Two of his three Open Championship victories have come here at St. Andrews, and here he is again, looking a little more sprightly than he was in Adair for sure, and looking a lot more comfortable than he was when he pulled out of the USPGA Championship after three rounds in May. What do you make of the possibility of Tiger Woods actually insinuating himself into the picture on Sunday and doing something which obviously would be just magical to see him even contending?
If it was going to be anywhere, it was going to be here. I mean, I really think if Tiger had not had some incidents in his personal life and with his leg and with his back, and if it just had a normal body and future going forward from say 2007, I think at the end of the day he would have had more claret jugs than green jackets. I've always thought links golf was perfect for him. Now we talk about the, it's funny to call it flatness of the terrain when we're at St. Andrews, but relatively flat terrain in terms of no hills to climb except for the Swilken Bridge. We have the mind that's so critical here in terms of thinking and creating shots and his iron play, which is still just so sublime. And you add all that together and you're thinking, you know, this place is magic. It most of the time creates magic. And would there be any greater magic than Tiger Woods, right? But at some point you have to step back and realize age, realize injury, but also realize the fact, Greg, this is going to be his 8th competitive round of the year this year. And that's, I think, what should give you the most pause is that, yes, he can play. And again, he looks like he's walking a little bit better, certainly than he did at Southern Hills in Augusta. But in terms of sharpness, he's played four rounds at Augusta in April. He played three in May at Tulsa. And here we are in July, and he hasn't truly competed since then. I think some expectations clearly should be tempered.
Yeah, no, I think there is a lot of tempering of expectations, but it's just that he's turned up. He does look almost better each day than he's on the range. His ball speed is in around the 170 mile an hour mark, which is kind of tour average, so he's got his ball speed to that point on 1 3/4 legs or whatever it is he's standing on. So you don't need length around St. Andrews. It's playing hard and firm out there. It's actually reining in your length to avoid the bunkers, which are beyond the bunkers you're trying to hit over. So length isn't going to be an issue. The putter was an issue, I think, in Southern Hills and clearly at the Masters over the last couple of rounds. So, look, I mean, it's not just going to be Tiger will talk about, but because he is who he is and he's had the history that he's had, do you think there's even a chance that he will be in contention?
I would never say there's never a chance. And that, what is that, like a triple negative, which is probably breaking every grammatical rule. But yeah, I can see it. Am I expecting it? No, but you just can never rule anything out with Tiger. I can see it because of all the reasons you state. And part of the reasons I guess I can see it, I was thinking back to Tom Watson back at Turnberry in 09. And yeah, that was a special week for him, and it was a special course for him. And it's links golf, and as long as he can get the weight and as long as he can get a few putts to fall. And Tom knows how to play links golf as well as anyone. Tom also has a deep passion for links golf in the Open Championship. So does Tiger, at least for St. Andrews. You just get a sense he is in such a peaceful, happy place to be back at the old course that you would think it would translate into his golf. And again, I don't know where that leads. Does it lead to making the cut? Does it lead to, you know, flirting on the fringes of contention, or even the dream scenario that he could be there? Then who knows? But I think just his utter joy and peacefulness about being here is going to carry some weight.
So if not going to be Tiger, just say that the dream scenario doesn't evolve for some people, the dream scenario, but clearly this is a 156 player field, and judging by the Open in 2015, when an amateur, Paul Dunne, led on his own after 52 holes, co-led after 54 holes, almost anything is possible around St. Andrews. So many of the amateur players would have played here in amateur competitions. So effectively, is this a field with 156 real contenders?
Did you leave out John Daly?
Absolutely.
Didn't leave out Mark Calcavecchia, who I'm thrilled is here, by the way. I don't know if you know that backstory, but his time ran out in 20, COVID. And in 21, he had back surgery, and he wrote the RNA and said, is there any way I can delay my final year to St. Andrews? And they, as Mark says, they fell for it. But now, no, you're right. There was a question to Spieth about how open is the field, which, yeah, I think he took some issue to in terms of why are you asking me this. And he brought up the reporter, and fairly so, he brought up Paul Dunne. He brought up Spieth. I mean, Spieth had never seen the old course until last time. So when you start talking about experience and knowledge of the old course, it is wide open. You know, even the ones who have come through in regional qualifying, they did so on links golf. It's who knows how the ball's going to bounce around here. At some point, nerves, pressure comes into it, and I think that's where you're going to get your separation. But yeah, I think it's less than 156, and it's more than one. Does that give me some wiggle room? I think it does.
Well, I'm gonna say something from the Irish point of view, because obviously I'm gonna be, you know, hoping that we have an Irish contender here. I looked up one of the American betting blogs yesterday, and they made Rory McIlroy as the favorite, and they made Shane Lowry as the third favorite. So that's not me. That's an American, one of these people who absolutely and utterly reads every single odds book that there is, or odds scenario that there is. I mean, Rory is in possibly close to the form of his life, certainly this version 2.0 of his life. He is probably the favorite here. In the Irish bookmakers would probably have it that way. But he's clearly the world number two. Scottie Scheffler isn't quite in the same form as he was in earlier in the season. Is Rory the favorite, do you think?
I kind of lean toward John Rahm, to be honest with you.
In spite of his sort of so-so form, just the one victory in a lesser PGA Tour event in Mexico?
I do. I would want to point out very clearly that I have no idea how these boys are going to play tomorrow, and I'm pretty sure they don't either. So, yeah, you do look at form. Rory's looking great. If you're looking at form, I don't know how you get past Xander Schauffele. Having won his last three starts, if I'm not mistaken. Are we including the JP McManus Pro-Am?
Absolutely.
I think that's the fifth major. no, but what Xander did at Hartford, and frankly the Travelers, and getting a little bit of help there at the end from South Thigala, and the way he played the Scottish last week, that's two wins in his last two starts, and he's a class player in the majors and has shown that. He needs one to get a breakthrough. So, yeah, I think all eyes are on Rory because everybody likes Rory, and that includes me, by the way. I mean, I'd love to see Rory have to stop answering questions about, gee, Rory, it's been 8 years. Are you ever going to win one again? And he can almost stop trying to talk himself out of it and into it and just go play golf and do what Rory does. But yeah, I just there's something about Rom that I've liked in Lynx golf. For a guy like him, and you fairly point out that it was a weakish field in Mexico. He hasn't been quite on form with putter, at least early in the year. But I like the way he plays Lynx golf, and I like the fact that when you're that good, form is never too far away. So I would look at Rom, and again, you cannot get past Rory. And I'm not terribly surprised that whatever unnamed American book source or whatever that you cited has got Shane at number three. I love seeing Shane at more than just the Open Championship. His hands are just so terrific. I always kind of fancy his chances, at least on a Wednesday going in. But Xander, yes, I think Spieth is one of the great mysteries in life. He's certainly one of the most entertaining and nerve-wracking players to watch if you have a rooting interest in him. But his putting, I think, on Lynx greens, I just think make him a threat. He's been around a lot more than he used to be in terms of contention, and screws it up at the end too. But that's what makes him so entertaining. So you just got done mentioning a minute ago, if I'm not mistaken, that 156 players in the field, and you're asking me who the favorite is. I'm leaving out Calcavecchia. I'm fair enough doing that, right?
Greg,
Greg,
just on the subject of potential winners, what do you think the reaction would be if a LIV golfer won?
I'm going to give that one to Doug. That's a real hospital pass.
I think it'll be noticed, Dave, but I think the RNA will take the high road. LIV golfers that are capable. Louis Oosthuizen, we never talk about him because he's just been a guy who's taken the money and kept his mouth shut, which I kind of wish the rest of them had done.
And won by seven here 12 years ago in the Open.
And got the right side of the draw as well, too. I'd have to give it that. But, I think people will, I think the storylines that come out of this would mention that heavily. But at the moment, again, I think the RNA celebrates the players who are here competing for the Open Champion to be Champion Golfer of the Year, even though they don't like the league they're playing in. And then going forward, I think it'll be a different story in terms of who wins. I think it'd be interesting to see what kind of, reaction they would get from their peers. I couldn't help but notice this week so many practice rounds had games of LIV players in them. Really, really stood out to me. Mickelson with Paul Casey today and a couple others who escaped me, but it almost seems like they are really clustering together.
Yeah, and I think there's an element of, segregation almost. Certainly there has been incidents of that on the DP World Tour already. Munich, the tournament about 3 weeks ago, there was apparently notable, not ostracization of LIV players, but certainly a separation. Doug, in a word, Xander Schauffele?
Did you just put a word in my mouth?
I did.
I'm going to say yes.
That's two words, actually, Xander Schauffele. Yes, it's just the one word. And I'm going to take over. There's going to be a lot of people really surprised at this. Seamus Power is going to have a great week. And I think Padraig Harrington could actually get himself into one of those each-way positions if we're going to talk in betting talk. But there you go, Dave. I am rooting for an Irish winner, and we've got a great hand because our top three players in the top 50 of the world rankings, one of them the world number two, another one the world number 22, Shane Lowry, Rory and Shane, as I've mentioned, have a great, great chance. But so too do 154 other players. It's that kind of a tournament. Everybody fancies their chances around St. Andrews.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it, Greg, isn't it? It really is wide open. And as I said, I think we're all really looking forward to 4 days of great golf. And as you said, hopefully the Irish challenge will be strong heading into the final round and the closing holes at St. Andrews on Sunday. So for the moment, gentlemen, thank you very much. Greg, we'll talk to you tomorrow, looking back on day one from St. Andrews. That's our golf chat for the moment. Coming up, we'll be discussing ladies football.
Game on 2FM.
We'll get to ladies football in a moment, but first of all, Nadine, just to update listeners on the GAA press release which came today regarding the Hawkeye incident at the weekend. I won't read the entire press release, but just to pick out a couple of lines, the most important lines. A combination of unrelated issues, including minor hardware failures, led to an erroneous finding for a score towards the end of the first half of the first GAA football semi-final, which was promptly queried by match officials who subsequently took the decision to award the score. Full end-to-end testing of the system will take place this week, after which a final decision will be made as to the deployment of the system for Sunday's All-Ireland hurling final. Hawkeye have also confirmed that there were no historical issues with the system and that the problems experienced relate to last Saturday only, and specifically to the Hill 16 end goal for that specific moment in time. What do you make of that?
Well, there's a lot in there. Listen, with any technology, like, technology is flawed at times. I trust that they'll do their homework this week. They'll do the tests. I'd hope that it will be in operation. I mean, it hasn't malfunctioned before. On the day, the refs were very quick to react. They awarded the score as it should have been. I think they dealt with it really well. And I'd welcome its return for the finals, because I think it has played a really important role over the last number of years. And for one mistake or one malfunction on Saturday, I think there has been so many positives from it, and so many games have rightly been decided with Hawkeye. So,
and of course, the good thing was, yeah, that relating to the weekend game, is that it didn't really affect,
exactly,
because
yeah,
it was such,
exactly,
a difference in,
yeah,
the end. That
yeah,
had to be a point either way. Obviously,
of
it
course
would have been a much a bigger issue. But okay, leave it there for the moment. In terms of the ladies' football, as we said, obviously a big win for Donegal in terms of getting over the Dubs at the weekend. You've had we mentioned at the top of the programme, but you know, you've had a few days to maybe reflect on it. Is there anything specifically that you think you'll take away from it, and that maybe surprised you, or that you're particularly impressed by the Donegal performance, or maybe underwhelmed by the Dublin performance?
Yeah, what I was really surprised by, Dave, were the Dublin tactics. I think it was a huge factor that Donegal got over the line. I think the Donegal management outsmarted their counterparts in a way. I think matchup wise, McBowen went with Sinéad Goldrick on Niamh McLachlan, and it totally backfired. Niamh plays a style of football around the middle whereby she's not making probing runs into the defence. She's more of a give and go, a Kieran Kilkenny of sorts, but she's huge pace. And Dublin decided to sacrifice Sinéad Goldrick's game to look after Niamh. And I've never seen Sinéad Goldrick, I suppose, get such a tough time, get such a roasting. So that was a huge factor, because Dublin then missed her in the defence. So that was the first thing I was surprised at. I was really surprised about how Donegal moved Dublin around the pitch. Like, I've never seen Dublin moved around the pitch in that way. And Donegal created such space. I mean, they got space that I couldn't see them getting. Moved the ball at pace, moved Dublin around, and Dublin mustn't have watched Donegal in their Ulster Championship, because throughout the Ulster Championship they moved Geraldine McLachlan out to the midfield, they moved Katie Heron into the full forward line and out. They did that again on Saturday, and Dublin seemed very unprepared for it and by it, and they were just huge factors in Donegal getting over the line. And in terms of being impressed by Donegal, listen, that team have been building up to that moment for about 5 years. They're the kind of team, when they go in against form teams or teams, I suppose, who are rated above them, that's when they're at their best, that's when they're at their most dangerous. And they were able to put together 70 minutes of complete perfection. Like, it was really, really impressive football. You know, their defence, their old guard, who I always mention, again, they were at the fore. Karen Guthrie came on at half time, made a massive difference, scored 2 goals. Yvonne Bonner, Niamh Hegarty, Geraldine McLachlan, Katie Heron, just the usual, you know, the household names.
That is a serious impact, isn't it, to come in?
It's huge, like, you know, and those girls, they've been at it for so long, and just what I really loved about it, they had huge confidence in themselves and each other and the game plan. It was just really evident, and I'm so happy for them that for once they were able to put 70 minutes together, and it just showed what they could do. They blew away, for me, the favourites for the All-Ireland this way. And, you know, Dublin got that consolation goal at the end to bring it back to 6 points, but it could have been over 10 points, you know, so it was brilliant.
And Meath, of course, the defending All-Ireland champion, still on course for a successful defence.
Yes, absolutely. A cagey game. There was definitely no love lost between Meath and Galway. And, you know, coming into the game, both teams, you could say, weren't at their best. Eamon Murray, the Meath manager, even before the game, alluded to the fact that, you know, Meath aren't really reaching their standards. You know, they were up by 5 points with 10 minutes to go. They seemed to be cruising, and I suppose they just, I wouldn't say they fell apart, because obviously they got over the line, but you know, they let Galway back into it when really they shouldn't have. But credit to them, you know, they took the sting out of Galway then. They kept possession. There were a few good strategic fouls around the midfield, which was very clever. Monica McGurk actually made an incredible save. It was just near the end of the first half. And for me, that proved crucial. And I suppose they got over the line. Roisin Leonard had an opportunity on the play just before Emma Duggan scored that final point, and had Roisin Leonard nailed that point, we'd be looking at Galway in a semi-final. But look, that's football. But credit to Meath, they're still due a bigger performance, I think. I hope it isn't this weekend against Donegal, but they definitely have to go up another level, I think, because they're kind of uncharacteristic at the minute, especially in defence. Like, that's their foundation, and they're just a little bit lethargic. You know, they gave away a few scores there at the weekend that it's just so unlike them. You know, they're not bossing that defensive unit like they usually do, so they look to improve on that. But look, credit to them. Emma Duggan again, who hasn't been, you know, she hasn't been reaching her own standards, to step up and get a point with 10 seconds to go in that manner was amazing. So look, we're very worried about them.
Now, I suppose for a long time Dublin and Cork were the two heavyweights of ladies football, but obviously Dublin beaten at the weekend and Cork beaten as well.
Yeah, Cork. Listen, Cork have been very disappointing again this year. I really thought that they'd challenge with the new management in. It was a wide open game of football, as the scoreline would suggest. And, you know, if you rack up 17 points like Cork did, you'd expect to get over the line. But for me, there were a few key moments in that game that made the difference. Lisa Caffrey's goal, it was Cork's old Achilles heel of their kick out. They made a mistake and Lisa capitalised on that. And then key to that, shortly after that, the Mayo keeper at the other end, Aisling Tarpey, pulled off two incredible saves, one after the other. Cork got the rebound, but instead of soccer style, they picked it up and they were denied. And then, look, it just, for me, came down to Mayo were hungrier, and Mayo's big names really stood up. Aisling Tarpey, as I mentioned, in goals, Catherine Sullivan, Lisa Caffrey, and I thought Fiona McHale had an incredible game. She kind of nullified Ciara Sullivan. And look, Cork's big names, they didn't perform. And I kind of wonder about Cork. You know, I saw Hannah Looney coming in there at halftime. She's not long back from the States. Eimear Scally made a big impact, but again, doesn't seem to be training with them up until the last couple of weeks. So you kind of wonder what is going on with Cork, because no more than Donegal, the potential has been there. So look, they'll reflect this year, and I expect they will come back next year and be in that top five, but they'll be extremely disappointed because they were heavy favourites, Dave, absolutely.
And also to mention Kerry getting over Armagh.
Yeah, look, again, wide open game, really entertaining. I had tipped Armagh, absolutely, but Kerry were hungrier, as we thought they would be, very hungry, because Armagh had, they deny it, but they'd chosen what they perceived to be the easier route in the series. So I suppose they maybe downplayed Kerry a little bit, but Kerry were really full value for their win. They had high energy, and contrast Armagh, very low energy. Armagh's decision making was very poor, and they just had an over reliance on Amy Mackin, and I just felt that Kerry overall were much more balanced all over the pitch, especially in the middle third and up front. And Kerry and Mayo is very, very hard to call. It really is, going on that Kerry performance. They've just been building and bubbling all year. They're a really super team to watch. They're really well organised, and they play that Kerry football. It's really direct, it's really open, and they're a joy to watch.
And if we were to push you for a winner there?
Yeah, I mean, it's really tough to call. You'd look at Mayo, they possibly have a little bit more experience, but I'm actually going to tip Kerry. I think Kerry are going to get over the line by the minimum. And I'm not saying that with absolute certitude, because Mayo, you know, they do have that experience. They could come good. But I just have a feeling for Kerry, especially after the weekend.
And Donegal, as we said earlier, now facing the All-Ireland champions. So if they are to get to a final, having beaten the Dubs, they now have to beat the All-Ireland champions.
Yeah, they have to go to that level again, Dave. And, you know, these two teams met in the league final. And on the day, Donegal got off to a really slow start. They had poor kickouts. They made, you know, uncharacteristic mistakes. They were down by 7 or 8 points at one point, came right back, levelled the game. But I feel if they avoid that uphill battle that they seem to give themselves at times, they're in with a huge chance. It's interesting, because I think Meath's strength lies in their defence. Donegal's defence almost lies in their forwards. I think Donegal have the ability to move Meath around the pitch the way they did at pace against Dublin. But look, Meath have to go in as favourites. They have to. They're All-Ireland champions. They've already beaten Donegal. But I just think if Donegal put that 70 minutes together again, I think we could have a draw after full time. And I'm just going to tip Donegal to get over the line and extra time if they can put that complete performance in again.
And where do you think Meath are now in terms of them? Obviously made a big breakthrough last year, very successful campaign in the league as well, so they're used to winning. But you know, I'm not saying there's a lot of miles on the clock, but you know the point I'm making, that has it taken so much out of them that there's going to be like losing a semi-final, there's no shame in losing a semi-final, but you know the point I'm making, is it a good time maybe for Donegal to be playing them?
Yeah, you know, Meath, I think emotionally as opposed to physically, it has drained them. They set themselves extremely high standards during the league. You know, we were constantly given the line of, you know, we're out here to prove we're not a one-hit wonder. And, you know, fair play to them. They proved that above and beyond. But I think it drained them. There were other outside factors. You know, there was a lot of AFLW talk around Vicky Wall. And they did look tired. Now, they're still putting decent performances together, but they're not at that level. And there'd be no shame in losing a semi-final to Donegal. They're not ready to lose a semi-final. I don't think this team is ready to go anywhere. They'll have huge confidence in themselves. And I think that last-minute win, I suppose it would have reminded them of their last-minute win against Cork in the semi-final last year. But it's very different going into a semi-final as firm favourites, which they are this year, as opposed to last year where nobody had given them a chance. So that, I suppose, it was much easier for them to self-motivate last year, whereas now the pressure is all from the outside. So it's how they deal with that huge pressure. And it is. I mean, it's massive, massive pressure. They're a young team. So I do expect them to aim to get to that level, obviously, on Sunday, but it'll be very difficult. And Donegal are a hard team to play. They're not your predictable team. And Donegal, their whole game plan and their whole setup is to counteract the system that Meath and Dublin play. It's set up to counteract a counter-attacking team. So that's why I feel Donegal struggle with maybe the lesser teams who don't set up with the system. So they will very much be ready for Sunday.
Will
for
there
Saturday.
Be a good contingent going up from Donegal?
I hope so, yeah. I got a few texts about tickets today. So I'm sorting as many as I can. And yeah, I hope so. The girls deserve it. And I really hope so. I hope people don't, you know, take the viewpoint that Osher will go up for the final. I think the girls need and deserve the support this Saturday. So yeah, get the John McGinley bus down and there'll be somewhere for people to stay for sure.
Absolutely, enjoy it. Listen, for the moment, Nadine, thank you. That's our ladies' football for the moment. Coming up, we'll be discussing the weekend hurling, the weekend All-Ireland Camogie quarterfinals.
Game on 2FM.
Now, Saturday is a quarter-final day in the Glen Dimplex Senior All-Ireland Camogie Championship. Waterford against Limerick and Kilkenny against Dublin. I'm now joined by Aoife Murray to look ahead to the games. Evening, Aoife.
Good, how are you?
Good, thank you. So let's take the first game first, I suppose. Waterford against Limerick, and then we look at the second game in a moment. But Waterford-Limerick, a difficult one to call?
Yeah, I think the more you look at it, the harder it actually becomes to call, which I think is a great sign of a quarter final and maybe what it should be. I think it also reflects the group stages of just how tight it was between both groups, Group 1 and Group 2. I suppose in many ways it's a day that Waterford now have become quite accustomed to. However, they've been accustomed to coming second in that match. So, you know, that can be a habit as well, and a habit hard to break. So you might look at this as a little bit of advantage Limerick, because I suppose in many ways it could be seen for a team that got relegated, I think, down to Division 2 in the league this year. It's bonus territory for them. So is there a little bit more pressure on Waterford to finally break the quarterfinal and get into that precious semi-final spot?
How much do you think that is a factor in terms of being on the minds of the players?
I think certainly it has to be somewhere in the back of their minds, because a huge amount of this group of players have been there for the last 4 years, and they just haven't seen the brighter side to the quarterfinals. But equally, it has to be, I suppose, an extremely motivating factor for them to get through on Saturday. You know, a bit of history getting through to that semi-final. In many ways, I hope that Derek Lyons, and listen, I think he's done a great job there, really, after settling in, he should, I hope, be using it as a massive motivational tool for them on Saturday. And, you know, I would expect Waterford really to be sprinting to that finish line.
And then we have the second game, the second semi-final, Kilkenny-Dublin. Kilkenny, I'd imagine, will be strong favourites in this one.
Yeah, and I think that's no disrespect to Dublin, but you would have to think Kilkenny being a constant top three team for the last 10 years or so, you would have to think that they are out-and-out favourites for Saturday. Nearly more so after that last game against Galway, because I kind of had felt that they'd kind of, you know, puffed and puffed their way through the championship in many ways, and then that last day against Galway, when they really came up against that top tier team, they really showed, I suppose, their grit, their determination, and their ability. So I think that probably couldn't have happened at a better stage in the championship for either Galway or Kilkenny getting to that quarter final. Certainly Dublin are up against it, but to be honest, I think Dublin has really impressed me throughout how they've gone about their business in the championship.
And what about Kilkenny in terms of what you've seen of Kilkenny in the championship so far?
I think, in fairness, they are down a number of players. I think it's something that Brian Dowling would have touched on as well, just after that drawn game. And I suppose, look, even looking at the match reports, watching the games, they're still counting kind of on the same players. You know, if Gaul doesn't fire, they are going to be in trouble. Equally, I think they're still relying a little bit on Miriam Walsh, who has been a bit off form in the last years. And I would have always thought, playing goals against her, you know, I never liked her too close to the goals, because she had an excellent ability to make a lot of hay in very little room. So when she's on form, I think she adds something different to Kilkenny. But I think it still comes down to Gaul firing on all cylinders. So I can imagine Dublin really targeting her as a target for them to stop her having any impact on the game.
And clearly, from what you're saying, is she really is a key to the Kilkenny cause?
Yeah, and look, and it's out of pure respect for her, to be honest, from what she's done over the past few years. And, you know, from even the games I've watched, standing on the other side of the fence now, I probably understand her impact far better. You know, when she goes out of the game, Kilkenny goes out of the game. When she comes back into the game, all of a sudden, you know, they've got a few points on the board. They've had a goal chance, or they've scored a goal. So for me, her impact, or her ability, sorry, to impact the game is second to none. So if you're Adrian and you're looking at what you have to do to stop Kilkenny, then certainly you would be looking at your defensive line and going, who is going to pick her up, or do we have someone to pick her up? And we flooded the fence with bodies. I would say she's someone that you would sacrifice somebody for them to go and do a man marking job on.
And just in terms of the semi-final, I know in previous years they've had the actual draw for the semi-final after the quarter-final. Is that the case this year?
I believe so. It's probably something I should know. but
sorry about
I
that.
Believe you're fine. I think it is an open draw for the semi-final. So, you know, it could be, it's all up to, I'm nearly sure it's an open draw for it. So, look, either way, the two teams that go forward, you've Cork and Galway waiting there. Two different routes in many ways with that last defeat, to Tipperary, quite a sore defeat for Cork Camogie. Will they have the ability or the time to pick themselves up and get themselves back in a real positive mind frame? You know, that is the big question there. Obviously Galway flying it through the championship and then having that very, very fine battle at the end of the championship. So either way, you're going to have four teams. And I think for one of them, especially the Limerick and the Waterford game, I think for me, that really is the one that you will be tuning into in the sense of it's going to be such a massive step for either of those counties to go forward to the semi-final. But that's what you want to see. You don't always want to see Cork, Kilkenny, Galway and Tipperary in those semi-final spots. So, you know, in many ways, they've probably thrown up a lot of fresh bodies as well into the championship. So it'd be an interesting one.
Aoife, nice talking to you. We'll speak to you again soon.
Cheers. Thank you.
Game on 2FM.
Now it's football talk and into the final minutes of the Women's Euros game, which is on at the moment between Sweden and Switzerland. And David Wilson of RTE Sport has been watching the game, and you can give us the latest.
Yeah, it's just coming up to the last kick of the game, I think in the 97th minute we're in now. It's 2-1 to Sweden. Benison from, she actually plays with Everton, she scored a cracking goal to go 2-1 up just before, or a couple of minutes before that. Frida Linderolfo put Sweden ahead with a lovely finish on her left foot, and then about a minute later Switzerland equalised with a Ramona Backman keeper made a bit of a mistake, and she, in fairness, she put it into the far corner. It was a great finish, but it's been a really good
just
game.
Gone full time.
It's just gone full time, and played in the sweltering heat of Sheffield, something that you know probably all about, Paul.
yeah, I guess I do.
The sweltering heat of Sheffield, has that a phrase ever been uttered before?
Well, I've done a few pre-seasons at this time of year in Sheffield, and Dave's right, it can be quite warm, but a big win for Sweden. I thought they were really impressive in their first game against Holland, so that was an important one to just graft out and see through, because it puts them now in a really good
The Dutch in action tonight. We touched on at the top of the program about Shamrock Rovers, guys. Obviously, the game itself, not a game to live long in the memory. But in terms of what it means for Shamrock Rovers, six more guaranteed European games now, be it in the Champions League, the Europa League, or the Europa Conference League. But in terms of playing Ludogorets now of Bulgaria, 11 successive Bulgarian league titles, it's a big step up.
It is a massive step up, and Shamrock Rovers were pretty fortunate with the tie that they had against Hibernians in the previous round, but they approach it professionally, they did what they had to do, and now it sets them up with a really good opportunity of a good European campaign. I think if we're being honest, the journey is most likely to take part in the Europa League or the Europa Conference League. This could be a bit too much of a step up in class, but they have shown in previous campaigns when they played Slovan Bratislava last year, they ran them very close. They were 2-0 down after the first leg, and that's the type of performance that they're going to have to avoid. They have been a bit too open, Dave, at times when they've played in Europe. The Flores-Tallinn game was another example of that. They probably will have learned from those experiences, and I think they'll run Ludogorets close, but I think just with probably the golfing resources and the golfing European experience, Ludogorets, you would imagine, might just have a bit too much.
David, just in terms of Irish internationals on the move, of course, a high profile transfer of Nathan Collins yesterday to Wolves, but Shane Long has a new club.
Yeah, Shane Long, he's gone back to Reading. That's where it was his first English club. Signed there from Cork City. He scored 54 goals in 203 appearances at the club, and then in 2011 he went and he joined West Brom, but he signed a 1-year deal. Ralph Hasenhüttl spoke about his professionalism and his he set a good example in the dressing room at Southampton, and he was really well liked, and he had a great career at Southampton. But I think this is a good move for him and back to his roots, and probably doesn't have to do too much travelling for with a family as well, so it should be a good move for him.
Also, Kieran Clark completing a season-long loan move from Newcastle to Sheffield United, and MK Dons signing Republic of Ireland under-21 midfielder Dawson Defoy from Bohemians for an undisclosed fee. And Paul, just of course, in terms of a high profile, a really big transfer today, Raheem Sterling, his time at Manchester City has come to an end, and he's now a Chelsea player.
Yeah, an important signing for Chelsea, Dave. You know, they've probably looked to Europe for their signings over the last number of years, and you think about the four players they'd signed: Timo Werner, Ziyech, Lukaku. They spent serious money in that department, and it hasn't really worked out, so they've gone for the tried and tested within the Premier League. I'm a Chelsea fan, I think this is a bargain. It makes complete sense. He's only 27 years of age, still got plenty left in the tank. He is guaranteed goals. He scored 10 Premier League goals in his last 5 seasons or more, 10 goals or more I should say, and he just seems like somebody who will slot quite well into that Chelsea system. His game time has been quite limited over the last 12 months, in particular at Man City, so it probably makes sense for all parties involved here, and I think this is somebody that Chelsea can look to build around. As I mentioned, the other players haven't really worked out, and it doesn't surprise me that they've gone for somebody who's English and who has experience of playing in the Premier League.
And would you expect him to be a regular starter at Chelsea? Presumably the amount of money they've spent on him, you would say yes.
Yeah, you would imagine so. I think what he has shown in previous years is that, yes, he can be frustrating at times, but he will always be there in those positions. He's the type of person who will just pop up in the 6-yard box and get you those percentage goals that are needed. And Chelsea have really struggled, you know, in many competitions over the last number of years with regards to their conversion of chances, and that has probably held them back to actually winning more silverware, particularly under Thomas Tuchel. But it's somebody that you would imagine with the amount of money they've invested here that you would expect that Sterling and his representative were going to be saying, if we're going to move here, we have to be guaranteed to play. So yes, you would imagine he's going to be one of the first names on the team sheet.
And the move of Rafinha to Barcelona is moving ever closer?
Yeah, I think this one's been on the cards for a while. Deco was his agent, he used to play for Chelsea, and he seems to have played this well because he was linked with Arsenal, then he's linked with Chelsea, but it seems as if everybody knew that his heart was set in Barcelona. Reportedly £49 million. Don't ask me how Barcelona are financing this deal if they still owe Frankie de Jong and the guts of 7 to 10 million in wages. It seems ludicrous. The financial fair play rules that seem to be in place don't seem to be respected by Barcelona, so hard to understand how they're financing the deal. But for Leeds now, that's the second big player they've lost. First Calvin Phillips, now Rafinha. They struggled last season. Those two players were pivotal for them when they were fit and ready. And you would expect that Leeds are going to have to invest a bit of that transfer fee back into the squad, because it could be quite difficult for Leeds again next year.
Okay, well, listen, thanks to all the Game On team tonight, including David Wilson, Ronan Lawler, Laura Lee Davis and Nadine Doherty, and to Afric O'Connell for keeping us on air. Tara Coomer is up next.